Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is the second of 11 conversations with former Secretary of State George Shultz and his granddaughter Kelly Shultz. Originally recorded in 2006, they talk about personal family stories and dig into his experiences as a young Marine and the important lessons he learned from sports. We hope you enjoy this week's podcast and be sure to stop by each week for a new episode of the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
How are you?
You're terrific to come here and we'll have this conversation together.
Thanks for inviting me. I'm very excited. So on Friday, I'm turning 18 and I'm about to head off to college. And I really have no idea what area academically I want to pursue. And I was wondering, when you were in my position, what goals did you have set for yourself?
Well, when I was in your position, I was off to Princeton. And I thought I'd like to play football and basketball and all those things. But I somehow was interested in economics. And I don't know quite why that is, but anyway, I think my father had a lot to do with that. So I knew from the beginning that I was interested in that. And I was also interested in how you might use it. I was more interested in using economics than just studying it as such. So how would it apply to public policy issues, and how would you use it in a business? So my interest grew as I went along in that regard. But also sports were important to me.
Football.
You're a pretty good sports girl. You're a star. You got on the first team in the California region in field hockey, as
yeah.
I remember.
Get it all from you.
So you're a pretty good, you had to swing that stick.
Yeah. So how did you decide on Princeton University? Were there other universities that you were thinking about, or?
I think it was a little different then than it is now.
Yeah.
It wasn't so difficult to get in. I hate to think of what would have happened to me now. I probably wouldn't get in anywhere, but anyway. Princeton was right there in New Jersey. I lived there. And my closest friend's father had gone to Princeton. And he was a big fan of Princeton. And it's obviously, it's a wonderful school. So there was a sort of natural progression there. My father had gone to DePauw University, but he wasn't particularly pushing that for some reason. So I didn't get any pressure to go there.
And you played for Princeton at football?
I played football and I played basketball. I wasn't a star, but I played and I enjoyed it. I think sports teach you a lot. And I know in Boston College there are very good sports. And you've played sports. You're a wonderful swimmer. I've seen you swim. Your backstroke is fantastic. And your field hockey and so on. But I think sports teach you a lot of good lessons for your life. They teach you about accountability, because there you are in your field hockey team, and if you're not in good shape, physical shape, you can't run back and forth on the field and you're going to let your team down. So you have to be accountable to yourself to be in good shape. And then you interact with other members of the team, and if you miss your pass or don't get the ball over to where it's supposed to go, you're not doing your team well, so you're constantly accountable. And if you're in a more individual sport, like swimming, you're on your own. And then you know you won or you lost and how you did, and you put your input in and there's a result and you can see it. So I think sports teaches you all sorts of good lessons that you learn in your gut. And they teach you a lot for life. So I'm glad that you are good at sports and that you enjoy them.
Yeah.
I did. And still do.
You do.
Oh, yeah. Well, I play golf and
very good swimmer.
I swim, but not in a sporting way. But anyway, I enjoy it and I enjoy watching.
So do you think that your involvement in these sports affected the leader you became?
Involvement in sports was a big, great thing for me. And not only for the things you learn from sports, but the fact that if you're working on something very intensely and then and you don't have any relief, you don't do so well. So I want to tell you a story about that.
Okay.
When I was nominated to be Secretary of Labor, I was told that President Eisenhower would see me if I wanted to make an appointment. And so naturally I did that right away. And I went to Walter Reed Hospital where he was, and he had gone there, and he died about 4 or 5 months later. But anyway, here was this genial man lying in bed, and we talked about the Department of Labor, and I was surprised at how much he knew about it. His Secretary of Labor had been a friend of mine, a terrific guy named Jim Mitchell, and we talked about golf and how we enjoyed golf. And so, and we had a wonderful conversation. After about a half an hour, a doctor came in to tell me it's time to go. And all of a sudden, this genial man got very stern. He shook his finger in my face like this. And he said, young man, you're going to come down here and you're going to work 7 days a week, 14 hours a day, and you're going to think you're doing your job. Let me tell you that if that's what you do, there's no way you'll be able to do your job. To do your job well, you've got to get your mind off your job once in a while. Otherwise, the intensity will burn you right out. And you like golf as much as I do, I can see that. If you don't get out to that golf course at least twice a week and relax, get your mind on something else, you won't be able to do your job. So that's another aspect of sports. It isn't only sports, but something that you like to do that's distracting. Yeah.
I have so many vivid memories of the famous Schultz gatherings with cousins and pools and dogs and food, and I've really loved every single one of them, and I have different memories, and they're all great. And I was just wondering, out of all the holidays we spend together every single year, which one do you think is the most meaningful?
Well, they're just exactly what you've said. Mm-hmm. And what they mean to me is that there's a family there, and they're your relatives, and you get to know them. You sort of grow up with them, and they're your friends. And you know that in your family, the people who are there for you, and if you have something good that happens, they exult with you. Everybody's going to applaud about all the places that have been smart enough to admit you to college. And if something goes wrong, they are there to help you. And I think the aspect of the family gathering, having fun, getting to know each other, getting to respect each other, is important for that sense. So I think family is a very important ingredient in life, and I'm glad that we have such a big family and such a congenial family. Everybody seems to get along pretty well and enjoy each other. Mm-hmm. So that's the basic thing that means something to me that way. And I can think of a lot of our gatherings, the wonderful vacation we had and a family gathering at Christmas down in Mexico. And then we had one at the farm, remember that?
Yeah.
And we did a variety of things there. And I remember Charlotte saying, being a person who lives out here in California, that wouldn't it be wonderful if we had snow? So we went to bed Christmas Eve, and when we woke up, remember the snow was coming down so heavily, if you put your hand out in front of your face, you wouldn't be able to see it. It was just really coming down.
Amazing.
And then you were all out there in your flying saucers and sleds and everything on the hill opposite the house. That was great fun. Yeah. And they're all fun. They're fun when you come here. And enjoy life around San Francisco. But to me, the main thing is the gathering of the family together and the sense of sort of coherence that you get from that.
Yeah. How do you think that you laid the foundation for this family unity? What was the key ingredient in making sure that we all had these family values? Because everyone in our family is so close, and how can I instill these values in my own family?
Well, I think the key is to care about them yourself. And it's sort of watching the way you behave, not just what you say, doesn't make much difference if people say they want something or other or believe something or other if their actions are totally different. So it's the way you behave. And I think also from the standpoint of our family, we're lucky we have the farm. It goes back a long ways. My mother and father, your great grandmother and father, bought that place back in 1943, a retirement place. And then we've added to it. So now if we're all there, all 23 of us, everybody has a decent place to sleep. And more than a decent place, a nice place to sleep. And lots of things to do, places to play. Pool, ping pong, train, everything is there right on the property. Then you can go to other places. So that's a physical place that's ours. And everybody refers to it and belongs to it. It belongs to us all. So I think that sort of symbolizes the coherence of the family in a way.
Do you think that when your mother, your parents purchased the farm, did they have this envision in mind?
Well, probably just a little bit. When they purchased that farm, I was in the U.S. Marine Corps in the Pacific fighting the World War II, and I was their family. I was an only child, and that was our family, my mother and father and me. And then when I came back, I liked the farm, and Obie, my late wife Obie, she loved the farm, so we kept going there. And when we lived in Chicago, every year after the spring quarter was over, we'd all get in a car and leave Chicago and go to the farm, and we'd spend the whole summer there. And I had a little place where I worked, but did my writing and so on. But we were there for a couple of months, and everybody, of course, had an experience together and got to know the place very well. And that was the start of this sort of family spirit. Then we outgrew the house. Wasn't room for everybody. And so we decided to build a new house up on the hill above where the old one is. And I remember that was kind of controversial at first because it was expensive. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have all the money in the world, so you really had to work at it. And we cut down its size a little bit and so on. And finally decided to go ahead with it for exactly this reason, to provide a place where all the family could come.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is great that we can all be there at the same time. And yeah. Everyone's comfortable.
Everyone's comfortable.
No one's sleeping on top of each other, and it's nice. You mentioned being in the Marines, and I've been aware of how proud you are to be a Marine. And I was wondering, why the Marines when you enlisted? And why not the Air Force, or why were you attracted to
them? Well, the Marines were at the forefront of World War II. When I was in the process of enlisting, the Battle of Guadalcanal was going on, and that was a Marine battle. And in many ways, it was a turning point. It was the place where the Japanese, having been advancing all the time, the Marines stopped them and started moving in the other direction. So the Marines looked like a real strong outfit to me. And so I decided to sign up. And it's been a lifelong experience, as you say. Once a Marine, you're a Marine. You start out in boot camp.
How was boot camp?
And boot camp, there's nothing lower than a boot. You're not a Marine, you're a boot.
Oh, no.
And you have about 10 weeks of really tough training. And you learn about leadership, and you learn about followership, and you learn about the importance of discipline. You get yourself in great physical condition. You learn about your rifle and how to handle your rifle, how to keep it clean, how to shoot it. And so you learn about life as a Marine, and if you get through boot camp, then you become a Marine and start in.
I read somewhere that you, before becoming Marine, you tried to enlist in the Royal Air Force. Is that
true? Yes, well, the Royal Air Force was fighting the Battle of Britain. And so that was spectacular. And I tried to enter that, but my eyesight was such that it disqualified me because I didn't have good depth perception. If you're going to land a plane, you've got to have pretty good depth perception. And I didn't have it, so I didn't get anywhere in that, probably just as well. Want me to tell you about my first landing as a Marine?
I do.
It was kind of, I'd been on British Samoa first, and I learned a little of the Polynesian language. And then we were all sent up to a little island called Funafuti. And all of a sudden, somebody tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Lieutenant, you're going to take your platoon, get on a destroyer, and you're going to go up to an island called Nanamea. You'll disembark in the darkness. You'll land before daybreak. The island is lightly held by the Japanese, so you'll surprise them and take the island. And then we'll come along and build an airfield in a, as it turned out, a medevac place. So the day comes, we get on the destroyer. We unload it in the darkness. We have these little boats, and the tides were not right, so the boats couldn't get in. They hung up on the reefs. So we had to get out of the boats and wade in a long distance. It's kind of tricky because the coral is up and down, and you have to watch your step. It takes a long time. You're holding your rifle up so it doesn't get wet. And by the time we managed to get to the beach, dawn had broken, and it wasn't like we thought it was going to be. But on the beach was lined with natives. And in the middle was a man in a white robe. So I walked up to him. And in my best Polynesian, I said, "Talofa soli," which means good morning, sir. And he looked me over carefully. And he said, "Good morning, Lieutenant. We have been expecting you. The Japanese left 2 days ago. So we didn't have to take the island from the Japanese, after all. But they were back by noontime, and there was only one structure of any importance on the island. It was a big church with thick walls. And they probably thought we'd all run to the church when we heard the bombers coming. But for some reason we didn't. We sort of scattered around. And they put a bomb right in the dead center of the church. So we were impressed with their marksmanship."
So were you disappointed when you heard that they had already left, or?
No, I wasn't disappointed.
Relieved.
I was perfectly happy we managed to get the island with no casualties.
You've had many exciting and prestigious jobs, but which ones were the most fun?
Fun?
Yes. I know there's probably not much fun in some of these serious jobs, but...
Well, all the jobs are very intense. You work very hard. But working with President Reagan was a lot of fun. I'll give an example.
Okay.
When you travel with the President as Secretary of State, you work very hard because you worry about his meetings and you have your own meetings, endless breakfasts and lunches and dinners. And you're the one that gives the press conference at the end of the day, and you're open for questions about anything going on in the world. So you have to study up and so on, and you get tired. So on this particular trip we took down to South America, we came to the last press conference, which was on Honduras, and I gave my press conference. And I got back on Air Force One. I sat down in my seat. I had a drink. Put my head back. I had a little pasta dinner. Put my head back and I went sound asleep. And President Reagan came back and he saw this. And he got a photographer. Then he posed in front of me in sort of an imploring pose. I'm out to the world. So we get back to Washington and over comes this photograph. And President Reagan had written on it, "George, wake up. the Russians are calling.
No.
So that was kind of fun.
Yeah.
And then Nancy Reagan, when there were White House dinners, would always have me seated next to some Hollywood star. And it was fun to get to know those ladies. And on one occasion, my dinner partner was Ginger Rogers, the famous dancer with Fred Astaire.
Yeah.
You've heard of them.
I've heard of them.
They're terrific. They were the rage in my time. So I got to dance with Ginger Rogers, and people took pictures. So I signed one and sent her that, and I sent her another one and asked her to autograph it for me. And I have it hanging up right over there. And it says something like, "Dear George, what fun. For the first few minutes, I thought I was dancing with Fred." So that's about as good as it gets. So that was fun. So we had some fun along with a lot of hard work and some difficult times. But in the end, things turned out very well.
You are a good dancer. I got to dance with you at the father-daughter dance.
Oh, we had a ball, didn't we?
Yeah.
We went to the Pacific Union Club. I had on my black tie. You had on a stupor dress. And I was so impressed, Kelly, because you went in there, lots of people. You didn't know anybody there, nobody, except me. And you engaged in conversation with I don't know how many people, lots of people. So I said, boy, I better watch that Kelly. She's a very attractive young lady, which I knew.
Thank you. You were a good date. Where did you learn to dance so well? That's what I was wondering.
Well, my mother insisted when I was, I don't know, about 14 years old or so, that I go to dancing school. So I went to Miss Florence's dancing school. And I didn't want to be there. I would have been rather out playing football or something. But anyway, I was there. You were all dressed up and you had white gloves. And they had the same number of girls as boys there, and they lined up on opposite sides of the room, and you were supposed to go ask a girl to dance. And I didn't want to be there, so I didn't rush over to do anything. And guess what I got?
I got the girl
left over. Oh. And so I said, that's never going to happen to me again. But anyway, I learned to dance at Miss Florence's dancing school, and I enjoy it. And Charlotte enjoys it, and we have a good time dancing, and you're a good dancer. We have fun.
I think I need to take more lessons before I go dancing again. That was really fun. Who were some of your role models when you were my age?
Well, my father was somebody that I really thought my father was. He was a terrific guy. And he was a scholar. He was a writer. He ran a school very well, developed it. He liked sports. He'd play catch with me endlessly. In those days, you worked a 5.5-day week. So Saturday mornings, he'd go into work, and he'd often take me with him. And so I'd go in, and after work, he went to New York City. We'd probably go up to Columbia and watch a football game or go to something or other. So we spent a lot of time together, and he was a wonderful father. So I guess he'd say he was my role model.
That's nice.
And I can imagine, because I know your father very well, that he's a pretty good role model too, and so is your mother.
Yes, I have lots of very good role models in my life. I'm very lucky. You've been a great one too. This weekend, when I found out that I was interviewing you, I called all the cousins and I wanted to know what they wanted me to ask you. And this is one of my last questions. And Lena really, really wanted me to ask you.
Lena, she's a pistol.
She said, "Kelly, you have to ask Great Dad what his favorite baseball team was when he was a teenager."
The St. Louis Cardinals. Oh. Was my favorite team. And they were known as the Gas House Gang. They were very colorful. And they would put on pregame shows throwing the ball around. And they were very good. They won. But they were a very colorful bunch. And they had a pitcher called Dizzy Dean and an outfielder called Joe Medwick. They called him Ducky Medwick for some reason. And very colorful players. And Dizzy Dean, the terrific pitcher, was he talked about himself a lot. And somebody said to him once, "Hey, Diz, aren't you bragging?" And he said, "It ain't bragging if you done it." So he done it. But they were, that was a great team. And I, whenever they came to the New York area, I would try to go and watch them play. I never went to a ball game in St. Louis, so that's, but I still root for the St. Louis Cards.
Really?
Yeah.
So you'd go to games in New York?
Yes, we'd go. There, that time there were three teams in baseball, major league teams in New York. There were the Brooklyn Dodgers, they're now in Los Angeles. The New York Giants, they're now in San Francisco. And the New York Yankees, who are still there. And depending on who was playing and who you wanted to see, it was easy to go. You take the bus across the George Washington Bridge, you get on the subway, and you go to one of these. And I and my friend would do that. Our mothers would put up sandwiches for us. We'd go early. We'd watch batting practice. We'd watch infield practice. If it was a doubleheader, it was all right with us, but that's a lot of baseball.
That is a lot of baseball.
Yeah.
All right. I don't have any more questions, but this has been great interviewing you.
Well, you're a wonderful young lady, and I'm very proud of you, and I'm proud of all your cousins and all my family. And it was interesting to me that in your questions you put a lot of emphasis on the family, which is very heartening.
Well, I love how I get to see my cousins so often, and my aunts and my uncles, and it's great living so close to you and Charlotte. Get to see you a lot.
Good. Okay.
Feel very lucky.
Well, we're going to see you Sunday night.
Yeah.
Okay.